You're listening to the Book Talk Today podcast, a podcast that inspires readers to obtain valuable insights to inform, educate, and improve lives. My name is Orhan Abdi. I'm an avid reader, best known for the creation of the 1 Minute Book Review community, and I'm sitting down with authors to delve deeper into the books they have written to uncover the story behind the story. Hello, Book Talk Today family, and welcome back to another episode of the Book Talk Today podcast. My name is Orhan, I am your host, and in today's podcast, we are joined by Harry Parker. Harry joined the British Army when he was 23 and served in Iraq in 2007 and Afghanistan in 2009 as a captain before stepping on a bomb while on foot patrol. Now he walks on metal legs. He is now a writer and artist based in London. And today we discuss his new book, Hybrid Humans, Dispatches from the Frontiers of Man and Machine. And Harry has a very unique story as someone who not only served in the army, but someone who unfortunately experienced tragedy when he stepped on an IED and lost both legs. And in this book, he talks about his personal experiences of waking up in the hospital bed, having no legs, and essentially learning new technology in the sense of walking on metal legs and how he had to learn from scratch. And the book talks about disability, how we can see disability, and some of the thoughts and ideas around how we should go about labeling people with disabilities. And it's something we talked about in our conversation as well. But we also talked about what new technology does, and where the boundaries are between disabilities and people who have new technologies, and how they use those technologies, and where we're going in the future. It was a very interesting conversation, and Harry has a very unique story, and I really look forward to sharing this conversation with you now. If you haven't already, please do subscribe to the podcast. Every single week, we release a podcast with an author to discuss their book and the ideas and principles inside of it. We have some really interesting conversations lined up in the next couple of months. And whether you're listening to this on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube, the best way to support this channel is to head over to our YouTube channel at Book Talk Today and subscribe over there. That is the easiest and cheapest way that you can support this channel and grow our message out there. Thank you again for listening to this podcast, and I really hope you enjoy this conversation with Harry. Harry, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on. I'm really excited to be on.
I'm excited as well to have you on because your story is a very unique story and one that got me quite emotional reading it, because I think anyone who reads about this type of story almost imagines himself being in that position. And you know, you definitely took the reader on a journey in this book, and a lot to be grateful for, definitely. So before we get into some of the elements in the book and this idea of hybrid humans, I think it would be great just to give an introduction into your story and how you came upon writing the book.
Yeah, sure. So I joined the army when I was about 23, I think it was 23. I'd been to art school and then went into the army, which is a slightly strange route, but that's the way it happened. And yeah. Pretty normal story, really, in terms of I went to Iraq for a bit, and then I went to Afghanistan. When I was in Afghanistan, I trod on an IED, an improvised explosive device, and I was very seriously injured, and went into this really amazing but very complicated system of systems that brought me from the battlefield back to the UK, fixed me, you know, there was a bit of surgery. A lot of surgery. I ended up with a traumatic amputation from the bomb. So that happened as the bomb went off, and then a surgical amputation later through infection and things like that. And so I ended up being a double amputee. And yeah, went into what at the time is probably a world-class rehabilitation, you know, all the resources and therapists and people you could want to put me back together, basically, and all the rehab that goes with that. And I was given some of the best prosthetics out there in time. And the book really came about because that's 10 years ago now. So I was injured in 2009. And about 10 years after injury, I was starting to think about, you know, what it means to be someone who's dependent on technology. And in a way, it had become as normal as it was ever going to be. And so, yeah, I started to write about hybrid humans. But it was a journey. I mean, it's a bit corny to say it, but sort of a journey of discovery, really, for me. It's sort of quite personal quest to get out there and see what else was available in terms of technology, how other people dealt with it. But on that journey, I think it, and we can talk about it more, but it was just slightly surprising what I found out, and also the way I think about myself.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my earlier questions, actually, that I thought about when at the beginning of the book, because you were talking about grappling with your identity or who you are and what does it mean to be perhaps human or alive at that point. So on that journey, or perhaps immediately afterwards, when you're sitting there after the surgeries, how did your idea of self or what it means to be a self change?
Yeah, it was really interesting because I went from being in an organization, for good or bad, that pride sort of really... it prides physical ability and fitness, and you know, if you really dig under the skin, it, you know, it probably prides things like appearance, and it's very masculine world, although I think the military is getting better at all that stuff, but at the time it certainly felt like that, and there was really traditions of white British male macho-ness, really. I mean, that's the surface of the military. So I went from being in that environment where you'd say things like grow a pair to each other if somebody was not, you know, performing, or if you're on a run and someone was at the back of the group, you'd be like, you know, grow a pair, or, you know, man up, or sign a backbone out of the stores or something like that. Something really not very compassionate. Yeah. And I went from that sort of environment to being a broken body in hospital, waking up with no legs. And whole load of stuff comes with that, like embarrassment, because you essentially you're no longer in that team, you know, that you've been in, and I was doing all right at it as well. So suddenly there was this whole weird sensations of feeling guilty and embarrassed, and also more internal. You're looking at this body that no longer can do the job that I, you know, I did enjoy. So those are the first sort of feelings of embarrassment. But I think also there were people who'd come and sort of look at me in hospital or visit me. And not all, but some people, I think, you know, there was a bit of sort of hand-wringing and sort of, oh, poor you. And also people sort of saying, oh, I don't know if I could keep going if what happened to you happened to me. And I think because of that, and for them, my feeling about that was the fact that they were sort of looking at my body and thinking, well, he's broken, he's ruined, you know, how do you overcome that? And so if that's the sort of low point, then from then on, you have to sort of rebuild. But actually, internally, it felt much more hopeful than that. And I think part of that was to do with, I was lucky, you know, really tight family, great education, you know, and also having been to art school, I had a sort of idea of something I could go on and do. You know, it wasn't like, my job's gone, what am I going to do now? And I think for other soldiers, that's not always the case, you know. But for me, you know, I had this amazing education, and then also technology. You looked around and you thought, actually, maybe I can be put back together. Maybe I probably can be fixed.
Yeah, because at the beginning of the book, you said that if it happened perhaps like a year earlier, then you perhaps not have survived in the way that you did, which is really interesting to reflect on.
Yeah, so I, the book sort of charts, there's a chapter about sort of the technology or the technologies of survival, if you like. And I talk about this in Hybrid Humans, but the idea that if you were in central London or in a major Western city and you sustained the same injuries that I had, you probably wouldn't survive. You know, even if you were walking outside a hospital, I mean, if it was a trauma hospital, you probably would. But everything, even though I was in a dusty field, you know, in the middle of combat, having just come out of a firefight, everything was set up to essentially save me. You know, the people who were around me had tourniquets, the most simplest thing. You know, they had blood clotting powders that they could pour into the wound to stop me bleeding out. You know, they could call up a helicopter that could sort of, you know, just collapse time and space so that they could take me back to Cambastian, which was essentially had a trauma hospital in it that was better than any other trauma hospital in the world. I mean, every single bit of kit and multiple people who were all on duty at the right time, you know, all, you know, a minute away. So you have this whole system that could save me. And I think what's interesting about that is that there's probably between 400 and 600 British soldiers who who we now call it unexpected survivors, because they had such serious injuries that probably we should have died. But which is great, obviously. Anyone surviving is great, but with it comes a whole load of problems about, you know, how do you give them quality of life? You know, how do you give them mobility back and all that other stuff?
How much of your time was spent focusing on sort of like the physical rehabilitation, and how much was focused on like the mental side? Because I know you touched upon it in the book, talking about the PTSD side of it, and you talked about like obviously like the positive growth as well. And it seemed to me in that part of the book or in your story, you said that you can either go one of two ways. You can go down the growth phase and say this is an opportunity for me to learn and grow and become better, like obviously you have, or you can be someone that perhaps just looks on the negative side of it.
I think it's a bit more nuanced than that, and I think the idea that you have a choice in it is sort of difficult. So in terms of the first part of your question about the physical rehab and the mental rehab, what's interesting I think is for some of the really seriously injured people is you go into this year-long decompression, and it's very structured, you're looked after very well. You also have something to focus on. You have a real purpose. You know, I had a purpose to learn to walk again. When I came back from Iraq and I wasn't injured, I remember being in, you know, the Middle East one day, and then 3 days later I was in a pub in London. And actually that is a bit of a strange thing to do to your mind. And I can remember feeling some of those feelings that people talk about with post-traumatic stress, that idea of feeling angry, no one understands, you know, feeling a bit violent. Not that I did any of that, but I was very much noticed it in some of the people around me. So that's one thing. But then when I came back from Afghanistan, I was injured, you know. So I had this very long rehabilitation where they're, you know, doing loads of physio, you're in the gym a lot, you're getting new prosthetic legs, and you're having, you're sort of learning how to walk again, which is, you know, really difficult, quite painful, well, very painful at times. Yeah. It's knackering. So just to finish that part of the question, it's just the two things go hand in hand, I think. And often having physical action is a really good sort of antidote to trauma, actually. You know, having purpose and something to focus on. And then with the growth thing, I mean, so I think post-traumatic growth is a really interesting subject. And in the book, I describe how someone, sorry, I'm going on a bit, but
that's all right.
So how someone came up to me and said, how did you deal with your PTSD? And I said, well, I don't have PTSD and I've never had it. And they just couldn't believe me. They sort of looked at my legs and go, of course you have PTSD. You know, look at you. But actually, actually I didn't. And PTSD is a tripped switch. It's like a malfunction of the brain. And lots of people go through traumas and don't have post-traumatic stress disorder. Now most people have post-traumatic stress. That's the sort of the body and the brain's way of dealing with stress. If you're in a bad car accident, if you're sexually assaulted, I mean, even if you give birth, I suspect for a lot of women, you go through this post-traumatic stress, and it's 3 months long, give or take, and by the end of it, hopefully you're not having the dreams or, you know, the bad thoughts, and the body and the brain sort of dealt with it. The disorder bit, the D at the end of PTSD, is something that, you know, is a brain injury often, and I don't understand it all, but I didn't have that, or not yet. I mean maybe one day I will get it. So the growth thing is, and I think people sort of get this, we it's a sort of idea that feels right. If you go through something tough, sometimes you get this feeling of self-worth and purpose, and that's sort of what post-traumatic growth is. And I think from what the research says, you know, some people are better set up to feel it. You know, if you have close friends, a bit of money, support, those people are more likely to feel PTG, post-traumatic growth.
Mm. How do you deal with people who impart an understanding of how they would have gone through it onto you? Because like you said, it's like, oh, of course you're suffering from PTSD, or of course you're going to be feeling that way, even though you're not feeling that way. Like, how do you deal with someone imparting their belief onto you in that situation?
Well, I think, you know, having a bit of knowledge and understanding really helps, because then you can try and explain it. I think if they're quite entrenched in their views and they're not understanding, that can be really frustrating. But I think that's a good question. I think it runs through a lot of disability, that often people look at someone with a disability, whether they're visually impaired or they're deaf, or that they have a mobility or a motor disability, you know, or they're a neurodiversity, and they look at the person and they see the disability, and they think that the person is only experiencing that disability, you know, that that's their entire existence. And that's really interesting for me. It's one of the things I've really sort of learned, and I've learned writing Hybrid Humans, is that that people often, you know, if you make a speech at a wedding, so a guy who's visually impaired said to me, you know, if I make a speech at a wedding or I write a letter to the paper, people are like, well done, you know, brilliant, as if you know, because he's a blind person, he wouldn't be capable of it. So I suppose my point is that, you know, my disability is actually very little of who I am and what I experience actually day to day walking around. Even though I'm wearing these amazing bits of technology, it's a very little part of who I am. And actually my close family, my friends, my colleagues at work, they don't see it at all. They're not sort of, they hardly see the disability at all. And it's actually only when I, you know, interact more widely with society and people are sort of asking me questions on the pavement or whatever, that suddenly the disability becomes part of who I am, and I can be taken back into being a disabled person.
How do you deal with that concept or that term? Because I know in the book you don't particularly like that term, and you made it pretty clear that you don't like it. That is the whole concept of a hybrid human. Like you said, you don't like the stigma perhaps behind disabled. Like, how do you, when you go out and explain it and you talk to people about your experiences, how do you converse with someone who likes to label that as disabled and perhaps has their own stigma towards it?
Yeah, so that actually in the book, I think there's a bit of a transition from the start of the book. The idea is that I'm not comfortable with things like disability, and hybrid human sort of feels like something that's interesting to think about. But by the end of the book, actually through talking to lots of people and doing a lot of research, actually I'm more comfortable with disabled person. That feels, it's part of the sort of discovery in the book that actually people have sort of fought for that term, you know, and it's a protective characteristic. Which means that society is better. So I feel sort of less, less worried about it as a term. I suppose the reason at the start of the book, when I'm talking about disabled and disabled person, it just feels like a negative. And it also didn't seem to sort of sum up my experience, because that's not how I felt. It's not how I identify. So I was sort of looking around for some other way of describing my experiences. So sort of like, cyborg, bionic, do I want to be a cyborg, do I want to be a bionic man? And actually they feel a bit too sort of science fiction. And then they're sort of differently abled and things like that, and I think language is always difficult, and categories are difficult, and identity is difficult. So it's not something that I sort of want to impose. I'm not saying everyone should be like, we should now have a new category of person that's hybrid human, but it was more a sort of way for me to think about my situation and sort of what's at stake in terms of the technologies that I'm sort of interfacing with. I think that's sort of why hybrid humans came up. But I think, you know, disabled person, I suppose the last thing to say on that is what's interesting, if I park in a car park and I walk across to go into the shops and I've got my legs on, to most people I look completely abled, and actually I'm probably more abled than some of the more elderly people walking around. But what they don't see is that it's painful. It's, you know, I probably have an open wound in my legs, or it's rubbing, or I've got lower back pain. So that I'm sort of abled in one sense, but then if you took my legs off or if they broke, then I'd be completely dependent again. So it's this weird, I think technology also creates a weird situation where you end up with these strange sort of paradoxes, where at one end, you know, technology can make someone really, you know, really abled, and potentially not far in the future it might make you, you know, more abled than biology, and then the other end, you know, take the technology away or it breaks or the company that makes it goes bust, and you're complete dependence again. So there's some really, you know, it's really sort of complicated, I think, the sort of systems around a hybrid human or a, you know, a disabled person who uses technology.
Does your fascination with the technology stem purely from your ability to like use it, or your like day-to-day usage of the technology? Or do you think it's just interesting to think about technology in the wider sense and what it means to be like human? Because like I think of the internet, like we're conversing now through the internet, or you think of like a phone, because if someone, for instance, doesn't even use prosthetic legs or whatever it might be to help them get around, like a phone is an extension of yourself. Like people use their phone and their laptop as an extension of themselves. So technically we're all hybrid humans in our own way, and how we communicate with each other and the way that we use technology. So do you think it's just a parcel of being a human in today's age, just being hybrid in that sense?
Yeah, and I think that's hopefully why this book's really relevant, because I mean I try and talk about things like that. I mean, there's a paper now written in 1988 that's about extended cognition. Did I say 1888 or 1998?
You said
1988. Yeah, you said 1998. And it's called extended cognition. And the idea is that we delegate to objects in the world. And actually, in the paper, they talk about a notepad. So they talk about two people trying to get to the Museum of Modern Art, and one of them has Alzheimer's and one of them doesn't. So the person without Alzheimer's just walks there and goes in. The person with Alzheimer's has a notebook where they write down everything, and they find the page with a note on how to get to the Museum of Modern Art, and then they go in. And it's a sort of thought experiment that is designed to sort of show that, well, it's sort of asking the question, are either of those two individuals, is their experience any different really? And it also goes on to talk about, if you were to destroy the notebook, would you be sort of destroying part of that person's mind, you know, their memory? Mm. I think when you flick that onto things like a smartphone, where we've got all our, you know, got all our photos, and I know we back them up now, but all of our photos, you know, it's the way we navigate. And I think we're probably getting less good at knowing how to get around cities and things like that, because we just delegate it to to our phones half the time. You know, it's got, you know, we all know what it's got on it, so I won't bang on about that. But I think, you know, one of the things I say in the book is when you lose your phone, especially if you haven't backed it up, I mean, that can be really, you know, anxiety making, or make you really anxious, should I say. And it can have a really profound effect on how you feel and your ability to communicate and navigate and remember. So imagine, you know, imagine having a prosthetic leg and that breaks, and or you can't get it fixed, and how that would make you feel. I mean, it's sort of another level of dependence and hybridity. And I think, you know, at the end, towards the end of the book, I talked to some sort of the futurists, who are the people who think, you know, that we should be really melding ourselves with tech. And, you know, these are sort of guys that would like to upgrade the body, and in the end, get rid of the body altogether and potentially live in some, you know, substrate. And you know, when you think about the sort of that sort of anxiety and that idea that if you were to get rid of the technology, or the technology was to break, you know, how profound that would make you feel in terms of a loss. So I think, you know, and I suppose another part of your question, just to finish it off, was why what was sort of driving me about technology to write the book. And actually, I'm not really into tech. I think I am into it, but what runs through the book is more about the human, what it does to the human, you know, the human condition of it.
Through that discovery of analyzing what it does to the human, did it change your, I guess not opinion of it, but did it change your perception of what technology's purpose is?
Yeah. I mean, you've got to imagine me sitting in a limb fitting center, so like a hospital limb fitting center, for the first sort of 3 years of my rehab. And I've gone from a really rudimentary knee and legs that don't bend at all. And then I've had a mechanical knee, so there's no electronics, it just bends. And then I went through a series of microprocessor knees that have little brain, you know, little brains in them that help you walk. And each time, you know, I was given the next upgrade. And those upgrades came with all the sort of marketing material on the boxes. And I Googled it and watched the, you know, the YouTube videos from the companies of these people walking around smiling. And, you know, and you're lying in bed for the few nights before thinking, I'm going to be fixed. I'm going to be a new person. But then when you get it, there's always, well, for me, and they're often, these bits of kit are amazing. They are transformational. But there's always also a sort of, well, actually, it still hurts. I can't run. You know, they're heavy. You're sweaty and hot in the summer. And they're never quite, they never truly replace the biology. Or they can never truly get back to the biology. And I think, so there's that sort of disappointment. So that's one side of it. It's sort of, I've slightly forgotten your question, sorry. That was one part of it. Like thinking, okay, I've got to this place where I've got this amazing leg, but are there any better solutions? Are there better things I can do with technology? And then going through the book, I met, you know, some people going through some quite full-on surgical procedures in order to fix prosthetics to their bodies. People who some blind people who use different devices. I met people using exoskeletons and upper limb prosthetics. But throughout all of it, what was really interesting was that there was always a double-edged thing about how we fix the body and why we want to fix it. And I think sort of central to that is this idea that we talked about at the start of this sort of perfect body, trying to get back to that perfect biology, and whether that's a good thing at all, whether we should be more accepting of a disability and allow it to people who are disabled to interact more easily with society rather than giving them this kit to sort of try and fix them. So I think that's the interesting. Yeah, sorry, go on.
Interesting. So do you think in your discovery it was a lot less about trying to find the most perfect technology and rather just accepting that we need to allow disabled people to be more an integrated part of the wider society?
Yeah, but I think you can get into all sorts. I mean, it almost that these ideas sort of span the whole of society in terms of the way we, you know, we all look at social media and what's out there and compare ourselves to it. And we're all looking for this idea of the perfect. So I think it does span everyone. It's just with people with disabilities, it's more sort of acute in a way. Once you understand lots of things can be true at once. And I think we always try and, you know, put down on, you know, the right answer, but actually, you know, where we are upright animals that walk around. So you could say, let's not give Harry prosthetic legs. Let's just accept him in society. But actually the realities are that having prosthetic legs allows me to interact with society better.
Yeah, definitely.
Keeps me upright, actually makes me healthier. But at the same time, you know, making a building accessible in the most simple terms really helps, you know, that sort of accessibility. And, you know, if I'm in a wheelchair, then it, you know, that really, really helps. I think the last sort of example on that is like the iPhone. When the iPhone came out, the blind community thought it was going to be the end of them, of their lives, basically, and they were going to be left in the dark because it didn't have any buttons, so it didn't have any haptic feedback, so a flat screen. But actually Apple started to integrate accessibility into their devices and they built it in from sort of first principles. And now things like Siri and touchscreen and voiceover, where you can just press your finger, so if you're visually impaired, you can press your finger against the screen, it will read, sort of screen reader. The thing about Siri, I mean, I don't know if you use Siri, but it's quite useful to look up something, or you can even write an email with Siri. But for a visually impaired person, that is completely transformational. I mean, and then you can put apps on it, like there are GPS apps that get you around in a much more, you know, they can lead you around the city and tell you what's there. You know, there's a statue on your right and it looks like this. So I think, you know, some of these devices have been really transformational, and then a visually impaired person might have had about 4 or 5, maybe more, 10 different bits of kit around them that now can all be done by a tablet. It's sort of stuff to read your post, you know, braille readers, things like that. So I think,
There's been a lot of, I think, moves. Like, I remember when I started at school, like, there was a lot of a move to be more disabled friendly, whether it be like with accessibility to classrooms and all that type of stuff. And I have seen a marked change. I'd be interested to get your take about whether you still believe there to be a stigma around it, or how much you personally have experienced people to have a stigma towards you, and perhaps how you think that that can be dealt, perhaps at a societal level. Like, where does that start? Does it start with education? Does it start with more disabled people talking about it? Or does it start with perhaps, you know, at the school level, becoming more aware that people do suffer from these things, and they're not just, it's not like an us and them type of thing?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think education is, you know, it's always the way to go, and visibility. I think, you know, it has got better, but there, you know, Scope did a research study recently, and I think over 60% of the population find it hard or embarrassed to talk to disabled people or people with disabilities. I think,
yeah,
you know, I'm lucky that I have a disability that, you know, I walk around on very futuristic prosthetics, I wear shorts, it's quite visible, you know, and it's quite close to some of the sort of dreams of science fiction. And so in that sense, you might say it's even sort of cool. And there are obviously disabilities where that's not the case. And, you know, I did a lot of research about sort of disability hate crime and things like that. And, you know, that's a real thing that has been rising recently. And it's only happened to me once when someone said something to me that feels like they're attacking me because of my disability. But I think what's interesting about that is the sort of otherness, feeling like a sort of monster, of someone saying, you know, serves you right when you walk past them. And the sort of feelings you get of being an outsider or other. What's interesting is that if I'm walking down the street with my kids and just having a normal day, and then somebody comes up and says, oh, cool legs, and it's like starts looking at them and stuff, I sometimes get the same feelings of otherness, you know, of being set apart from what's normal. And, you know, we talked a bit about, you know, what is normal anyway, and that's part of the problem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think that it's weird that I get the same feelings of othering and feeling like a bit of a monster even when people are trying to be nice or inquisitive. So yeah, I think education, you know, hopefully things like this and, you know, books and you know, I think it's getting better on television, but in popular culture, more disability and disabled people.
How does it feel like from the parenting side? Like, I know you put some like really emotional stories about like your kids and their sort of relationship with your disability, but like, how did it feel having children and having the disability and educating them on it and explain to them like what does it mean to live with them? Because that must have been quite a journey.
Yeah, I think in you're right. In one sense, it is a bit of a journey. I mean, even the fact that I felt quite lucky to have them at all, because of the way I was injured, yeah. You know, you can imagine the blast damage and stuff. But so that in the first instance, I think, you know, you're so lucky. But then in terms of the sort of practical day-to-day of it, I think you just sort of get on with it. I think with really young kids, they obviously don't even notice it. It's just part of their day-to-day life. And so that can be quite challenging with like a sort of toddler who's running around near a road. And actually the anxiety of that, you know, being a parent when you don't feel like you can properly protect them. That is quite profound, actually. You know, this idea that they could be snatched away by someone or they could run into the road and I wouldn't be able to save them. I mean, that is an anxiety that I feel. But I think just generally, you know, it's great having kids. They're a great leveler. And that also, you know, I think in terms of my sort of rehab over the last 10 years, 12 years, or whatever it is, you know, I did a lot of rehab. Then I got a job and actually became a bit less active. And then, you know, you have kids, and I haven't been in a wheelchair since I've had kids, because you just got to get on with it. You've got to get up in the morning at 7 o'clock and you put them to bed at night. And, you know, there's no sort of, in terms of a sort of rehab tool, kids are quite good. They you know, you can't think about yourself too much and feel sorry for yourself because you're looking after two other small people.
How much time do you think about it I'm sure writing the book was a big experience and possibly reflecting on your experience and on your journey. But like day to day, how much do you think about it? And how much does it affect how you see life in general? Because I can imagine, you know, you always hear stories of people who go through experiences like yours, and they always say how it's like a second chance at life and they always appreciate every single day. Do you share the same feelings about it? How much do you think about it on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, well, I think what you're describing is quite close to what we were describing earlier about post-traumatic growth. You know, that idea that you get a second chance and you value life more. And I definitely feel that. I think one thing I don't sort of quite subscribe to is that idea that you've got to, well, I just don't think it's realistic to sort of seize every day and make the most of it. but I do, yeah. In a way, I suppose, even if I'm just lying on the sofa all day, I suppose I do appreciate that. But I'm not out there every day sort of seizing the day in quite the same way. I think
on Instagram talking about it, seize your day, motivational speaker.
Yeah. No, I'm not like that. I wouldn't be a good poster boy for that. But I think just in general, in terms of how, I think one of the, you know, I went as a scrubber, I went from this quite sort of privileged macho lifestyle, and then I was seriously injured and I became a disabled person. And I, you know, I do feel comfortable with that label now, but I think, you know, I wouldn't change what happened to me. Actually, it's made my life far more interesting. I have a far bigger range of experiences that I wouldn't have otherwise had. And it's going to be a bit corny to say it, and I, you know, I don't sort of want to be sanctimonious or anything, but I do think I have a different outlook on life and on people, on empathy and different people. And I do think sort of, you know, I do have. It has really opened my eyes to other people's, you know, how they, their identities and where they fit into society in a way that I don't think I ever would have had. And for that, I'm pretty thankful.
Yeah, it's amazing how those types of experiences, or to be honest, like any experience that someone goes through, it doesn't even have to be like physical, like anything mental, whatever challenge they're going through, how it's amazing whilst you go through it, how painful it can be. But anytime you reflect on it, it's always like, I wish it happened. Like no one really regrets when that happens, because like you said, it's an opportunity for you to grow, develop, and you definitely do see the world and yourself a lot more different.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, watching my family watch me. And I think you're right, when it's a sort of very personal, when it's a personal struggle and trauma, I think what's hard is when someone else is going through something. And those sorts of traumas can be, you know, there's that saying, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I think it might be bollocks. No, I think it is, because some things aren't good. You know, some things are really rubbish. Yeah. No good comes from them. And I think it's important to say that, because people do go through some stuff which is really tough. But I do think you're right, in the sense that my view is that it's often, you know, the sort of person going through it has a less tough time than, you know, let's say your child's ill, or, you know, someone dies near you. You know, those sorts of things can be, there's no good comes out of it.
Yeah, it's interesting when that observational aspect of it, like when you go through it, it's almost like you feel like you can do anything to sort of come through it. But when you see others and you don't have that control aspect, it's very difficult for you, because you're like, you want to do something, but you can't do anything about it. And you must have experienced that with your close family members and friends, when they used to say, they must have come to you and said, I wish I could do more. I wish I can do more. But there's obviously nothing that they can really do apart from just support you.
Yeah, I think you're right. And actually, while I was writing the book, my wife had cancer. So she went through sort of chemotherapy.
Oh, dear.
And she's sort of looking at that, and she's fine now. But look at being external to that. You know, all I could do was look after the kids, which was actually, you know, really helpful. But sort of, you know, and then going back to the sort of technologies, it was in the book, but actually I took it all out, this, her sort of journey, because chemotherapy is one of these technologies that fixes us, but has costs. And I think, you know, going back to some of the technologies in the book, there are, you know, there's some serious costs that come with fixing a human body. You know, we sort of know about them, because they, you know, they say these are the risks, and you sign the form that says, you know, these are the risks. And those risks can be really big, but it sort of depends on how big the benefit is of, you know, are these saving your life or is it just a cosmetic procedure? You know, there's different levels of sort of risks that people are willing to take. Although weirdly, prosthetic procedures, people take pretty big risks. But I think that runs through a lot of the book in terms of that interface. When you attach something to the body, or even you put something, you know, put some drugs into the body, there's a big cost there, and we're willing to take the cost to a certain level. But when you're a hybrid human or somebody who's dependent on technology all the time, you're sort of living with those costs and the friction, if you like, of the interface all the time.
So that constant friction, like, how do you deal with it knowing that potentially, you know, technology is going to be shifting from a year to year basis? Are you in a mindset where you're going to be a wholesale adopter of anything that comes out? And like, people, when the new iPhone comes out, they're standing outside the shop and they're waiting to get it? Or are you more on the side of, you know, this is who I am and I'm going to, you know, upgrade and use it with caution? Like, where's your relationship with your own personal use of that technology?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I'm probably closer to the second part. I'm not an early adopter, put it that way.
Yeah.
But I'm a skeptical adopter, I suppose, or something like that. But just in terms of, you know, being an amputee, or certainly my experience of it, is quite painful, actually, a lot of the time. And so, you know, I had this technology that was fixing me, and probably for the first couple of years, I was taking quite a lot of drugs, you know, pain medication. But that's another technology that has a side effect. You know, it made me feel quite nauseous. You know, you slightly felt like you were in a fog at times. So I sort of made the decision to come off all those drugs and try and deal with the pain in a slightly different way. And I sort of ditch one technology and try and learn to live with the pain, and I did. But you know, that's a sort of it's a sort of cost that I live with. But the costs of the pain are less than the costs of the side effects of the drugs. If that makes sense. 100%. Yeah. So it's definitely
you always hear about the negative side effects of those medications. Like, I think you talked about the opioid crisis in the book, and you referenced the US, who has a massive issue with the opioids in relation to whether it be physical or mental. But it almost seems like no one really talks about the negative side effects until people die from it. It's weird with that side of it. Like, how did your relationship with those painkillers, like, what was your relationship with them? Because obviously you wanted to take them because you wanted to alleviate the pain, but you also must have been thinking you don't want to become dependent on them, because you must have known that when people become dependent, you know, bad things can happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was prescribed a load of meds because I was in, you know, my body was basically blown in half, so I needed them.
Yeah.
Then there was this, you know, there's a sort of gradual reduction in the meds, but I think there was a moment where the balance of whether the benefit and the sort of cost of it, there was a sort of decision to be made. Either you stay on the medication forever, or you do something else and learn to live with it in different ways. So I think that's I hope that answers your question. It was a gradual. There were sort of moments where, you know, there was one moment quite early where I said, I want to get off all the drugs. And I did. And I felt dreadful. I mean, I know what cold turkey's like, and it was.
Yeah.
Get me the drugs back.
So there was
a bit of that going on. But eventually I got off it all.
Yeah, but it seems like, I think the running thread that I got from your book is this idea of acceptance and understanding, like, your body better. Like, do you, like, through the process of going through the rehab and the pain management and dealing with it from a day-to-day basis, do you have a heightened appreciation for your body and the senses within it, and just the whole proprioception around your body and how it feels?
Yeah, I think that's one thing that I talk about in the book is that idea of embodiment, you know, embodying ourselves and what it is like to embody a technology. I mean, it's quite a weird thing, but actually,
yeah.
My legs don't feel like a part of me in an emotional sense, although they do for some amputees, but they do feel like a part of me in a sort of embodiment sense. They're part of my body map. And in the book, I talk a bit about plasticity of the brain and how we can relearn as we get older. I think The other side of it was slightly linked, is I look at some of the bionic eyes in the book, and these bionic eyes, there's a few bits in the book about sort of the preconceptions about this really high tech stuff, and when you get the articles in the press, and they always hype this tech, because that's sort of clickbait, isn't it? I mean, that's what it feels like. You know, bionic eye, person sees for the first time. And it's only if you read, I mean, maybe not even the article, you probably have to go to the research paper to find out that actually the bionic eye is only giving a visually impaired person a few dots of light with which to navigate. And what was really interesting for me is that, you know, these very expensive bits of kit that only give you a very small therapeutic benefit, or, you know, I mean, that is a huge therapeutic, but if you can't see anything, a few dots of light is a big benefit. But what a lot of visually impaired people would say is actually the risks of that are so much that having a few dots in the darkness isn't worth it. But also, a lot of these technologies start to sort of encroach on what you were talking about, that bodily sense, you know, your proprioception, your hearing. And people who are visually impaired can navigate with just the sense of, you know, almost like echolocation of where things are around them,
yeah,
and their feel on the white stick. And when you then start to attach technology, that disrupts that sort of very elemental, visceral experience of the world they have. And I think that was really interesting, because we always assume that these really high-end, high-tech solutions, everyone's going to want them instantly. But they're still quite a long way off the sort of biology, what the biology can do. And even the body that is disabled, the disabled person, you know, even recreating that is in lots of cases, is really difficult.
I know a big clickbait one in the medical field is the Neuralink that Elon Musk is doing. And I know a lot of people think it's like, oh, what's going to happen when you put this foam into your like head, and then you can sort of transmit like Wi-Fi data and you can get access to the internet all the time. And then you read about it like I did, and I realized that it's for a specific purpose. It's just for people who have a certain disability. Like, it's not for the general population. Like, I'm not going to walk into a surgery and get a keyhole in my head. That's maybe like 50 years or 60 years, or maybe never. Like, I think a lot of people write these articles and these technologies come out, and they look over the fact that there are people out there that need this for a certain disability. It's not for the mass market, like a prosthetic surgery, like, I don't know, like a facelift, or like a, I don't know, a breast implant, or whatever it might be. Like, those types of things are different. Like, this is a whole different field of hybrid human, I guess.
Yeah, I looked briefly at the Neuralink in the book, and I think what was interesting is a lot of these very high tech discoveries and areas of research are, you know, it's disabled people who almost have bodies broken enough to be tinkered with. Sort of brain computer interfaces that I talk about in the book, you know, always there, you know, they're being used with people who have a clinical need, and they're not being chucked into healthy people, apart from some of the body hackers, although they're not quite down the sort of brain interface area. I think there's one guy I looked at in the book, a French guy called Thibault, who had he was paralyzed in a nightclub fall when he was in his, I think in his 20s, and a few years after, he managed to walk across the lab in a sort of exoskeleton that was controlled through a brain computer interface in his cortex. So he had to have holes drilled out of his skull in order to implant these electrodes. And I think the sort of risks that he was willing to take in order to push science forward, it's sort of quite astounding, really. We talk about people climbing Everest or, you know, breaking the 100-meter world record. I mean, for me, this guy has taken some incredible risks, and all he can do, he's been able to walk again, but it's not like he's walking for a cup of tea, you know, in his house or going out of the house. This is all confined to a laboratory, you know, and the exoskeleton that he's walking in is attached to the top, you know, attached to the ceiling with a hoist. So I think that's sort of those people who are willing to sort of, in a sense, give their bodies to science, to sort of be the pioneers, if you like. It's really inspiring for me, because there's no way I would do it. I wouldn't.
That is really inspiring, because he obviously, for the mass market, is going to go completely unseen. But the fact that he's accepted his what happened to him and said to himself, look, I'm going to try and push myself and go through all this pain and all this difficulty and stress that comes with it. Because I don't think, like, you've talked in this conversation a lot about the stress of having to go through and adopt that technology. Like, people like me or other people might see their technology as the savior, like you said, but there's obviously stress that comes with adopting any new technology, because, like you say, what happens if you come dependent on it and then it goes? Like, that's an amazing step that he's taken.
Yeah, and what's interesting is, I think, you know, in the net, there are a few different ways that these sort of fields of prosthetics are going, but, you know, things like AI, just to go back to the smartphone quickly, you know, it's very intuitive to use for most people. Yeah. You know, pick it up and in a day you can use it and you can pretty much navigate around it. But as you say, it's quite difficult to adopt a lot of this technology and it takes time. But things like AI and brain computer interfaces and Elon Musk's Neuralink, if we get there, the idea is that they become much more intuitive, and that, you know, this is where robotics and AI sort of converge. There is something pretty amazing there, because AI can be predictive. It can also do some quite clever things for the individual, because obviously, although our biology is, in sort of biomechanical terms, quite similar, and one prosthetic leg will probably do most people, our brains and the way we're wired is completely individual for everyone. So AI can help to sort of map a person's brain, the way they're thinking, so that an electrode can be designed specifically for them. There's quite an interesting example of that with a deep brain stimulator that was recently put in someone with chronic, or I say very, very bad depression. And the only way they could put an electrode into her brain in a way that would help was to map her brain using AI and imaging for a long period of time, so that the electrode could be designed in such a way that it was specifically for her in order to have a therapeutic benefit. If you put that electrode in someone else, it would have had no benefit at all, or, you know, done damage. Mm. So I think there's some exciting things that are happening at the moment in that sense. And I don't want to be too, you know, I don't want to be too sort of negative. You know, this stuff is transformational and it is amazing. I think it's something like the cochlear implant, you know, which is 600,000 people have had a device that replaces a loss of a sense. I mean, 100 years ago,
it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, people would have thought that wasn't possible, but that is incredible.
So what's your take on the future of these technologies then? Like, do you think are you overly optimistic about its ability, or do you very much fall in the middle and say, look, it just depends? Like, the question of AI is an interesting line. We've had a couple of people on the podcast to talk about what the future of the internet is, or the future of AI and machine learning, and it seems like people fall into many different camps. You're either the person who's like, yeah, let's go straight for it, let's get everything and let's live in the metaverse, or you're considered a Luddite where you're just like, do you know what, I want to go live in a forest. It seems to me you sort of fall in the middle. You're just like, look, we need to be conscious about what we use, but we need to understand where it fits into our specific lives as the individual and then adopt it from there.
Yeah, I think I want to spend a bit of time in the forest and a bit of time in the metaverse, I think is
balance it out.
Yeah,
spend time in the metaverse in the forest.
yeah, so it would feel no different at all. But I think I'm not that interesting, but I feel much more sort of, you know, and there are some areas I think are really interesting, like sort of the ethics behind hybridity. If somebody shot me in the leg, I was thinking about this the other day, and what would be the legal ramifications of that? Or if somebody came and stole my leg, you know, is that like stealing a part of me? And there's a case study of a guy, a Vietnam veteran in America, who was flying on a plane, and he was completely dependent on his electric wheelchair. You know, I can't remember what disability he had, but he, you know, he was completely dependent on his electric wheelchair, and it was an extremely expensive bit of kit as well. Anyway, it got damaged and broken in transit on the plane. And he then went through a massive legal battle, because it was going to cost hundreds of thousands of pounds. And also it was very difficult to remake it. You know, it's a difficult bit of kit, and it was it was bespoke for him. And what was interesting is that the airline was sort of saying, well, it's like a traffic accident where the person's not in the car, so we've just damaged his car, we haven't damaged the person, so we'll just give you the money for the machine, not for all the stuff he's had to go through, like having carers for a year and, you know, being fed by a carer and things like that. Or they just saw it as a baggage claim incident, but actually he won the case, and it showed that device was in a sense part of him, and they had damaged him. And I think that, so the ethics of it, and then we talked about the Neuralink, you know, what would it be like for you know, if I had a Neuralink and you didn't, and that Neuralink allowed me to, you know, I could have had this conversation and brought up lots of new information, thought four times faster than you, you know, and because you couldn't afford one and I could, you know, what would that be like? I mean, the sort of ethics.
Does that mean that I now have a disability then in respect to you?
Well, I mean, I suppose in some of the book is about that, you know, as we move forward, what does it mean to have a disability or ability, especially if technology can sort of make you more able, you know, what does the spectrum of ability become? And I think that's interesting. And I don't know. I think there are some amazing. So just to finish on your question is about where's it going. And I think what I sort of discovered in the book is there's sort of two branches to this. There's the sort of hardware prosthetics, and then there's the sort of slightly more science fiction, but definitely being worked on, regenerative medicine. So the idea that you replace the body with something biological, and then you don't have the problems of the interface, really, because you're just creating the body again. And we can do
it. You mean like regenerate a limb?
Yeah, I mean, that would be the sort of science fiction, regenerate a limb. But we do it in parts of the body. Wow. We've regrown esophaguses and quite simple structures. And so I suppose technically it's possible. And, you know, a limb is very complicated. And we're a long way from doing that. But if you think about something like a liver, which is actually really complicated structure, and that's why the body, you know, the body can't even regenerate it. Well, so when the liver's damaged, the body can't regenerate it. But if things like bioprinting, 3D printing, stem cells, stem cell research, I mean, it's not that outside the realms of the possibility that you could start to regrow things like a liver in the future. So that, I think that's quite interesting. And I think there is an overlap actually with sort of stem cells and there's a little bit of the book that's about some of these electrodes. So just to finish off, electrodes, we think, oh, just plug them into their brain, they'll be fine. But actually, as soon as you plug something into the brain or into any part of the body, there's a foreign body response or foreign body reaction. And so it starts to get walled off, starts to get rejected possibly, and you start to get infections. And also, if you're having an electrode that fires sort of, fires signals into the brain, our cells, you know, our neurons don't really like being zapped by electricity.
And so externally, and especially externally like that.
Yeah, right. So I think if you can, so some of these electrodes, they're talking about sort of hybrid electrodes that have stem cells. So you imagine an electrode and that has nerve, sort of artificial stem cell nerve endings that then can grow into the biological neurons, and you create a sort of almost perfect interface between body and device. So there's some really interesting areas for research.
I think the interesting thing for me personally is, like, I love the idea of, I like reading science fiction. I've always been someone who's interested about it. But I also like to be a realist as well. It's like, how possible is it to regenerate a leg? Is it one of those things, like you said earlier, like 100 years ago, no one would have thought that you'd be able to regenerate a sense that was lost? Like, am I someone back in the 100 years ago thinking that you can't do that, even though, you know, you might look even 100 years in the future and you'd be able to do it, and it'd be crazy. But how much you think about it is like the actual technology, and how much do you think is like the attitude towards it? Like, do you think like people's attitudes towards like what it means to be human? Like, I think about this all the time, like, what does it mean to be a human? Like, what does it mean? Like, is a human the words, the thoughts, the ideas, or is the human the sort of the corporeal body? Like, have you watched the movie Transcendence?
No,
the one where he with Johnny Depp, where he basically uploads his consciousness onto a computer, and then he sort of lives his consciousness through a computer. And that movie, it's not a great movie, but it's an interesting one to think about, because it really tries, it got me thinking about what does it mean to be a human, which I think most of these conversations about technology and artificial intelligence, they always come back to this question of like, what does it mean to be human? It's never really about the technology. It always comes back to like defining what it means to be a human, which is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And there's some of the book I talk about, embodiment, and because we always think of the brain as, in the last 20 years, the brain has often been thought of like just a computer running a program for us. I think therefore I am, basically. But in the book, and I think being dependent on technology, there's this whole idea of embodied cognition, where without the body, the brain doesn't function either. You are possessed by a body in a sense. And without the experiences of that, the brain wouldn't exist either. So it makes a much more closer sort of connection between body and brain. Because if you think about the film of sort of uploading into a computer, and people talk about, people talk about virtual reality, which is great, which is something I've looked at for the book as well, in terms of rehab and stuff. And the way doctors can train in terms of therapeutic. But if you were uploading to virtual reality, what would it be to not have a body? I don't know the answer. I'm not answering your question. I don't know. I agree. I think
I don't think it's a question that has an answer. I think it's just an interesting sort of, I don't know, fireside chat kind of debate. Like I did my first experience of virtual reality on the Oculus in my cousin's house, and I was a Jedi and I was fighting these stormtroopers and with a lightsaber, and you get lost in that world because you're doing it. And then I took it off and I'm like, I'm not doing that, that's not me, but I felt it as if it was me. Like it was sort of that dream state kind of thing where you experience it feels very visceral. You're getting the haptic feedback, you're getting the sound, you're getting everything, you're getting the whole immersive experience, but it's not, you know that it's not real. It's weird. It's a very weird place to be.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the next 10, 10, 15 years, there'll be huge advances, won't there? I think with the medical stuff, what's interesting is actually things like prosthetics don't move that quickly. The advantage, it's quite iterative, it takes time, but I think in some areas, particularly things like AI, you get suddenly a massive leap forward that is amazing. But I always think of things like cancer research. So there'll be like an article in one of the tabloids or something saying, new cancer research, cancer, the end of cancer, and then you read it and it's 10, 15, 20 years away. And I think with all this stuff, it's sort of it moves in different sort of time frames from the way perhaps we perceive it to, and some of the sort of articles about it suggest it does.
I think you probably would want it to move iteratively. I don't think you'd want there to be sort of like mad scientists out there sort of just doing whatever they want to do, just cutting people open and just doing random experiments of people. You probably want it to be iterative at that stage.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I was thinking, as you said that, I was thinking about some of the biohackers and body hackers that I talk about in the book, and these guys in their garages sort of opening themselves up and putting some device into themselves to try and to, as we talked about earlier. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not doing that. I've read about those type of people. I'm like, you need to find a hobby.
Yeah.
Right, just do something else. Yeah. Like, why are you injecting yourself with random stuff? Like, I don't see the benefit in that. I guess they're on the frontiers of science. Probably that's probably what they're thinking to themselves.
Yeah, we're waiting for the Neuralink.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, Harry, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was a really interesting conversation about hybrid humans. Your new book, Dispatches from the Frontiers of Man and Machine, the book right here. Where's the best place that individuals can find you, whether it be a website or social media?
I mean, if you can face it, let's go analog and shop local. I mean, just nip down to the local No, anywhere. I mean,
no,
really,
I meant the best place to find you on social media.
Oh, on me on social media. Oh,
yeah.
You know, I'm not that big on Twitter. I mean, I'm on Twitter, but I don't do much of it. I don't know. Yeah, maybe I'm more in the forest than the metaverse.
Okay, cool. I'll put the link to your forest social media in the link below so anyone can find you and get the book at all local bookshops near you. That's what I'll recommend. Not on the Amazon. Go to your local bookshop wherever you are and shop local. Isn't that the saying? Shop local?
Yeah, shop local. I think that's, yeah. Isn't it? I think that is good.
Yeah, I think it's good.
See another human.
Exactly. See another human, have a conversation. And yeah. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Harry. Nice. I really appreciate it.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I really hope that you took some inspiring words from Harry. Like I said, Harry has a really interesting story and it was really inspiring speaking to him because it definitely motivates you in order to learn more, grow more, and definitely give some perspective to your own life and your own issues as well. So thank you, Harry, for coming on to the podcast and sharing your message. It was a really interesting book and I really enjoyed our conversation as well. If you haven't already, please do subscribe to the podcast. Every single week, we release a podcast with an author to discuss their book and the ideas and principles inside of it. We've got some really interesting podcasts lined up over the next couple of months. And the best way that you can support this channel, whether you're listening to this on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube, is to head over to our YouTube channel, Book Talk Today, and subscribe over there. That is the easiest and cheapest way that you can support the channel to get the message out there. Thank you again for listening to this podcast, and I look forward to seeing you in the next episode.